Minds. And here is your host, Gary Cacciulio.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Everything Imaginable. I am your host, Gary Cacciulio. And before we get started, I want to thank everybody for listening and also thank the contributors to this show, who are Candace Sanderson, author of The Reluctant Messenger, Ms. Aida, author, psychic, spellcaster, root worker, witch. And you can find her at MsAida.com, MissAida.com. Also, Ginger Glasser. You can find her at TarotByGinger.com. She's a tarot reader, evidential medium, and healer. And also Alan Questel. And you can find him at UncommonSensing.com. And his book is called Intentional Acts of Kindness. And you can find it on Amazon. And now, without further ado, our guest for today is Justin Otto, who is bringing enlightenment to the Gulf Coast.
I don't know about that. Bringing something.
How can you bring something when there's nothing?
Right. I mean, but you know, nothing in a non-dual sense is everything, right?
Or vice versa.
No, I mean, it's all the same thing. There's just the one.
So we can pretty much end this podcast right now.
That's it.
We've said it. There's just the one.
That's it. Problem solved.
We could just
That thing you've been looking for forever? It's right there.
Man, this is the shortest podcast episode ever.
We'll have to like put this on a compact disc and you can start pairing it with your book. Customers also bought.
So really though, like, what have you been doing? Like, how did you, like, you know, reach the state that you've reached?
Consistent practice, man. And not just like on the cushion either. Like, oh man, I don't know.
Was there a dark night of the soul that led you to it?
Which one?
I don't know. What I'm asking. That's why I'm asking. If I knew the answer, I wouldn't be asking.
No, I mean, like, yes, there was one long extended dark night of the soul called my life. No, but no, to be like serious. Yeah, no, for sure. There was definitely some periods that were, really bad. Really, really bad. Yeah, you gotta swim through a lot of shit to get to the other side. I'm like Andy Dufresne.
When you're going through that kind of stuff, though, is it ever hard for you to sit down on the cushion?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or, sometimes, I'm dealing with all this bullshit. I'm not meditating today. I'm going to go do something fun.
Yeah. In fact, like just a few months ago, like maybe like, I don't know, it's probably been 6 months or so now, I was going through a particularly rough patch with some dark nighty kind of stuff and some really depressive episodes and just like, yeah, just despondent pretty much. And nothing seemed to be going right. And I couldn't sit. And so I made the decision. I was like, I'm just not going to sit at all. I'm just not going to sit. I'm going to put that on the back burner for now. And I'm just going to really try to just embody the practice and just be as mindful as possible in every other factor of my life. And that's what I did. So I just, for like 3 months, I didn't sit on a, unless I was teaching a retreat or I was, you know, teaching at a group or something. Like, I didn't sit on a cushion just in my personal life for like at least 2.5-3 months and was just focused on everything else. Like,
did you notice any difference in your perception?
I mean, not at that point.
No. So it was the same as what it was when you were sitting on the cushion?
I mean, yeah. Yeah. We're just, you know, all we're doing is just being with what is. So whether we're being with what is and that is the breath, or we're being with what is and that is doing the dishes. You know, meditation and daily life aren't really separate things. There's no distinction between the cushion and everything else. The encouragement is to bring that level of mindfulness and that level of presence into everything that we do, right?
How do you do that? How do you come out in everyday life and look at it from a non-dualistic perspective with absolutely zero judgment?
Well, I don't think you you definitely can't. I mean, you can intellectualize looking at it in a non-dual perspective, but there's, I feel like there's multiple stages to this thing, and there's the intellectual, there's the knowing, you know, and then we move from the knowing into the experiential, where we have these peak experiences, but they don't last. So we can enter these non-dual states. We can enter these shifts in perspective, but much like a psychedelic trip, it's in and it's out. It's, you know, it's quick and it's fleeting. Mm-hmm. And then there's this realization stage where like the hardware itself and, or the software either, maybe both, actually have a, some sort of a change, and there's a shift, and then it's solidified and it's there and it's locked in, and it's, and so far it's been that way for a couple months now. So. Hmm.
Do you tend to look at things now from more of a macro perspective rather than the micro, without the ego?
Generally. And I mean, you know, when we talk about the ego, you know, people throw around this word ego and the, you know, the term ego death, you know, to describe these peak experiences on psychedelics and mm-hmm. things like that. But with this process of awakening, or whatever you want to call it, I don't feel like it's not an ego death. Really what we're doing is we're uprooting the identity structure and seeing that it never existed to begin with, that everything that we think we are is at the end of the day, just a thought. You know, everything is just made of thought. Our entire identity, our past, our future, it's all just thought. And the only thing that exists is what's in the present moment, because that's all it ever is, right?
None of it's real. I don't even know if the present moment is real anymore.
So, you know, I've got some theories on that we could go around. And obviously, I'm an insane person who meditates a lot and has done a lot of psychedelics in the past and shit. But no, I mean, it's all an illusion.
Yeah, I even now it's not real. I'm starting to think that everything is just information, you know, more matrixy kind of reality.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so when you're really viewing the world through a non-dual perspective and you're really present, if you're, you can kind of train yourself to like be in these states more and more and more to where it's just consistent. It's kind of a switch you can flip, but in the non-dual state, there's no labels, there's no borders, there's no boundaries, there's no distance. And you, in that state, it's kind of like viewing the world on a movie screen. Everything just appears flat and there's no distance. Like really the only distance between, or the only difference between an inch and a mile mm-hmm. and a light year is it's a thought, right? So in this non-dual state, like distance kind of disappears and borders and boundaries kind of disappear. And reality, like true reality just arises, and it's kind of chaotic. I mean, it's, you know, the formless realm, right?
That's it though. That's where not only is it formless, but you can form.
No, you know, and form and emptiness are the same thing.
Exactly. It doesn't exist.
There you go.
It's really cool.
Samsara and Nirvana, all the same thing. Podcast over. It's all an illusion.
That's another one, yeah.
You can take your ball and go home.
But yeah, it seems real, doesn't it?
I mean, it seems the most real until you see through the illusion and you're like, oh man, that's... It's not real. None of it's real. Yeah.
It is, right?
It is and it isn't.
Do you think that we chose to be in this state of existence?
That's an interesting question, right? Do I think that? I don't know. You know, you hear that thrown around a lot, like, oh, you chose this path, like you chose your parents, and you hear all that kind of stuff. And I don't know. You know, I don't know. I could speculate, maybe. I don't know. I've had an interesting life. I can't imagine that I would have chosen all that, but maybe I did. Maybe I wanted the full experience. I don't know.
I used to disbelieve that. You know, I was like, there's no way I would have chosen this life. But now I look at it, I'm like, yeah, I would have definitely have chosen this life.
Yeah, for sure.
This is exactly, that's awesome. This is exactly what I would have wanted. to do.
It all worked out. That's an interesting realization, right? Like coming to that place where you're like, you know what? It's kind of perfect. Like just as it is, it's kind of perfect. Like are there things that, you know, could be different? Maybe, but I love it just the way it is.
Yeah, yeah. I think I came down here just to play in the mud.
Hey, man, that's what it's all about. That's what we're supposed to be here doing. All this other shit, all this society stuff, all this, the world of the forms.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to go through a period of deprogramming yourself?
I mean, I feel like I've been in a period of deprogramming for most of my life, if we're being honest. Hmm. I mean, I started doing psychedelics when I was maybe 14 years old. And, throughout my 20s was doing a lot of psychedelics. Well, my teens and my 20s, if we're being honest. And, a lot of that was like just kind of peeling back those layers and being like, oh, man, this is all kind of bullshit. But then we get, psychedelics kind of took the back seat and I found meditation, and that's been my thing for 10 years.
Hmm. So what's next then? Like that's like the weird thing I think like now is like you get, once you kind of learn how like enlightenment is just really a switching of perspectives. It's like kind of like, well, then what? As you mentioned it earlier, it's like that old Zen story of like you wash the dishes, mow the yard, feed the kids. Yeah,
what do you do before awakening? What, you chop wood and carry water.
Yeah.
What do you do after awakening? Chop wood and carry water. But, the thing is like you find the joy in chopping the wood and carrying the water. It's not just a chore anymore. It's the reason, right? Like everything that we do is the reason.
Now, do you ever look back and go, why was I so miserable about all that stuff before and I'm not now?
No. I mean, like, I guess I've maybe entertained that thought a few times. But ultimately, like, I don't think that it would be as profound of a shift had I not had the mental state that I had for so many years, right? No mud, no lotus.
Yeah.
You got to have a lot of mud to have a pretty lotus, right? So if it wasn't as shitty as it was, I don't think this would be as good as it is, if that makes sense.
Plus, there is no good, there is no bad.
All just perception.
Yeah. It's all just moving around.
The funny thing is, and I think I've said this already, is this right here. It always has been. It's always just right in front of us. Nirvana, whatever language you would like to use, whether you want to use the Pali or the Sanskrit. It's always just been right here. It's kind of like the Buddha said. He said this Dharma is clearly visible, but hard to see. You got to see it with just the right kind of eyes,
Yeah. Yeah, you just absolutely accept it as everything is what sort of just is.
And I mean, that's all it is it's the isness. And the funny thing about it is not only that it is, but but like everybody's experienced this. Everybody has experienced this state of nirvana, this state of cooling off, this reduction in reactivity where everything just kind of drops away. Everybody listening to this podcast, everybody that's not going to listen to this podcast, everybody on the earth has experienced this state. They just didn't know that's what it was. They didn't know what they were looking for and they didn't know how to recognize it. But we've all been there. Have you ever been so wrapped up in doing something that you kind of like, for lack of a better term, lose yourself?
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, I was, playing guitar and I just kind of got lost in it. I lost myself in that moment. That's nirvana. Because the self isn't active anymore. It's just the doing. There's no doer. There's just the doing. When we're in those states and we're in those heightened states of activity where we're really putting all of our energy or our effort into something, whether it's, playing an instrument or playing a sport or even cooking, whatever we can lose ourselves in is your path, right? Like, and I mean, everybody has multiple paths, but do more of that and really be aware while you're doing it. Because the self kind of drops away in those moments. And that's really what, this is a multi-path model that is, at least in the Theravadan lineage, it's like a four-path model. So, the first step in this whole awakening process is breaking the first three fetters. Mm-hmm. And so the we lose this identity of a fixed self, this constantly, persistently abiding self. We see through the illusion of that, you know, it's really in reality, all the human body is, all the mind is a set of processes, a set of processes that's always just changing and changing and changing. You know, our cells are constantly dying and regenerating. So cellularly, we're constantly being reborn. Our thoughts are always different. They're always cycling through different things, different emotions. They're never the same at the same time. And so everything is just in this constant state of flux. There's just this constant, persistent change. So that being said, like, what is there that's static? Where is this self? Well, the self is just an idea that we have about ourselves. It's a story we tell ourselves about ourselves. And, you know, I've really done a lot of thinking on this, and, like, you know, because I work with a lot of people in addiction and I do a lot of recovery stuff. And if we're addicted to anything, I mean, what are we the most addicted to? Our fucking selves, right? We're addicted to ourselves.
Big time.
If we're addicted to anything, we're addicted to that. Like, every thought that you, the listener, have comes from the reference point of I, me, or mine. It's always in relation to this focal point mm-hmm. of I. But that I is just an illusion. I mean, not saying that you're not here right now. I mean, maybe you are, maybe you aren't. But the idea of a fixed me, like some sort of persistent abiding self, that's just a myth. That's an illusion. That's a story we tell ourselves to try to make sense of a linear timeline in a world that time doesn't actually exist in. You know, time too is just a concept. Like, entropy exists. Time's an illusion. It's not real.
That's all absolutely true. Absolutely true. I really like, get back to what you said earlier. I was really struck because, like, you know, there's like, first there's the knowing, and like then like next there's like that practicing thing, you know, where you're kind of going in and out, and then there's the an awakening, like where like this major shift in perception happens.
Mm-hmm.
And once you're there, are you able? Are you constantly in that state, or do you have to switch back and forth?
Okay, so that's a really good question, actually. As far as like the perspective of there not being a self, right? Like, as far as like operating from where there's like no mental chatter in relation to me, like, oh, I got to go pay the bills, or oh, I shouldn't have said that one thing, or, you know, anything like that. There's no mental chatter of that nature whatsoever. It's like my default mode network, which is what essentially fuels that voice, that internal voice constantly, is just offline. And it has been for a couple months now. As far as like the non-dual, like perspective, like the non-dual seeing and like the no distance thing, I can kind of turn that on and off. I'm getting better at holding it longer, but it's literally like a switch I can kind of flip, which is interesting. But as far as the mental part, like that's just a constant. There's no voice. There's no self judgment. There's no self doubt. There's no self.
I don't know. I have two really fucked up questions to ask.
Okay.
How do you know it's not brain damage?
I mean, it could be, but hey, if it is, it's working for me, so I'll take it. If it ain't broke, don't fix it, bro.
Right. Or the other one is like, how do you know you're not going insane? Or do you ever ask yourself that? Do you ever say like, wow, that voice is gone in my head. It's like, I'm gone. So maybe I'm going crazy.
I mean, I feel like I was crazier before.
I would imagine so, yeah, because the voice is insane.
Yeah. The voice tells you to do all kinds of crazy shit. I think the voice is the devil. like even Buddhism kind of points to that, right? So like when the Buddha was, you know, setting about his awakening after his years as an ascetic, and he was sitting under the Bodhi tree and doing the thing, you know the story.
Mara, I know. I think we both have a tattoo of Mara.
Yeah, hey, there he is.
I got mine on my chest.
Yeah. So, you know, Mara came to visit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He showed up his greed and showed up his hatred and he showed up his doubt. You know, so like Mara is the personification of the Buddha's own mind, essentially, is what he is. Right? He's all the little, he's that little voice in the back of your head. It's like, yeah, piece of shit. Who do you think you are? You going to wake up? I don't think so. Who do you think you are?
But then it ended up helping him. I mean, would the Buddha have ever had that experience if it wasn't for Mara?
For sure. Well, Mara is, you know, is a protector, right? Like, really, Mara is there to protect you. It's a little protection mechanism that was installed when we were kids.
It's a filter.
Yeah. But guess what? You know, I'm not 6 years old anymore, and I don't need Mara's help anymore. So Mara can take the day off. In fact, Mara can take the rest of my life off. And so far, at least for the past couple of months, he has. So that's nice.
Are you off of the wheel of reincarnation?
So I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say yes. And I can say that in regards to this. So when we talk about reincarnation, there's a couple different ways we can approach this. We can talk about it from life to life, which is generally how it's understood. But we can also talk about it as far as identity, right? So we can look at all of the different lives that we have lived within this one lifetime in this form. So, you know, think about yourself. Think about all the different incarnations of Gary that there's been over the years, all the different little idiosyncrasies and different ways that you were throughout your life. You know, there was Gary, the long-haired metalhead, and then there was Gary, that, you know, I don't know what you did in your 20s, but you know what you did. So, you know, there's all these different identities that we have over our lives, right? Like I can look at myself and say, oh, well, you know, I have my identity as a son, and I have my identity as a boyfriend, and I have my identity as all these different things I've done for a living. You know, I was a musician for a while, and all these different identities, all these different hats that I've worn. And so we see the way that this identity and this personality is cultivated, and it changes over the years. Yet another thing that has no stability and is not permanent. So when the Buddha talked about, you know, I've wandered through the many, you know, realms of past lives, and like, I think that's what he was talking about. Like just all these different versions of himself throughout his life. And so when we see that the identity itself is a story, when we see that that is too is just made of thought, it has no solidity to it. It's not gross. It's ephemeral. It's like wispy and kind of like smoke. There's no stability to the identity. So when we see that the identity is just another story that we've been telling ourselves, we stop making new identity and we just start being what we are, which is just that isness.
Fascinating. So I've been reading this book. I think it's called The Science of Consciousness. Mm-hmm. And naturally, I've been reading a lot of books on this particular topic, that consciousness as we experience it, or what consciousness actually is at its core, its root core, is the universe experiencing itself. So we're all just a dream that the universe is having, essentially, so it can experience its own possibilities. Do you kind of believe that? Do you believe that we are just all universal, absolute consciousness having an experience of itself?
I think it is the universe being conscious, right? I don't think.
Well, yeah, so, I guess so. Yeah, if the universe is conscious, then everything has to come into existence.
Right. So we can look at it like this. And this is kind of part of how we arrive at this place of uprooting or tearing down the identity structure or the ego, or seeing through the illusion of that. is we start this process of like, not this, not that, right? So we start to look for the self.
Right. The negating.
Exactly. This is a process of negation. That's what the Dharma is essentially, is this process of negation. So we start negating things. So we can look in the external world and I can see all the things in front of me that are, that appear to be external and say, well, I'm not this, I'm not that, right? So I know that I'm not this, I'm not that, I'm not this pair of glasses, I'm not the camera, I'm not the laptop here, I'm none of these things. And so then we move to this, what is left? Well, this thing here. Well, I can observe the body. And whatever is observable is not the self, because the self is the thing doing the observing, right? So whatever is observable is not the self. So I can observe the body. I have this body, but if I cut my arm off, that's not Justin. Justin's in there somewhere, but even Justin's just a thought, it's a name. So if the body's not me, well, then what else is there? So there's the mind. Oh, well, I can observe the mind too. I can see thoughts arise. I can see thoughts pass. I can see thoughts that are constructed on their own, which does, again, doesn't happen anymore. And then I have the volitional thought, which is all on me. But what's doing the thinking, right? So this is where it gets a little funny. Then this is normally where people kind of come to the place of talking about the witness or the observer or consciousness or loving awareness. I've heard people put it that way. I think Ram Dass put it that way. But again, whatever is observable is not the self. So if I can, because I can be aware of awareness and I can witness the witness, I can observe the observer and I can be conscious of consciousness. So if I can observe that too, then what's left?
Pure
nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. Space. Empty space. Kind of like the universe. But again, in a non-dual sense, if there's no self, that means there's no other.
Mm-hmm.
Which means that nothing exists outside of that empty space.
This universe doesn't exist.
It does and it doesn't. It's like Schrodinger's cat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another thing I read recently too about really good, cool theories, like rather than there be multiple particles in a universe, that there's only a single particle. And because of that, you know, it's like you know how we have quantum entanglement where, you know, particles are all basically able to communicate with each other because they're all pretty much the same particle. So really the only thing that exists in the universe is this one particle.
Maybe.
And because this one particle exists, the only other possibility is for everything else to exist. Because it makes sense, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's the funny thing about this whole thing is like, it's all just very paradoxical, right? Like, that's why Zen is designed, you know, that's why they have the koans. It's like, you're kind of just breaking the mind with a logical paradox, which is the universe itself is very paradoxical.
It is. Yeah. But I do think, though, that in a lot of ways, science is kind of coming around to looking at things from a more spiritual point of view.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I think just people in general are becoming more open.
I mean, I definitely will agree with both of those statements. I know several people who are getting more into the spiritual side of things as time goes on. Definitely seeing an uptick on that for sure. And I actually just had an interview earlier with Daniel Ingram, and are you familiar with his work?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote the Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. Really, really good book. Basically, it's a commentary on the commentaries. So it's a commentary on the Visuddhimagga and the Visuddhiyana. So, but he's also a part of, what's, called the EPRC. And it's got it written down right here. It's the Emergent Phenomenological Research Consortium. And so basically what they're doing is they're taking all these different experiences that people have had, whether it be through, spiritual practice, or through psychedelics, or through maybe diagnosed or undiagnosed mental malady. We won't call them problems because maybe they're not problems at all. A lot of the things that they talk about in the mental health realm are very, very similar to things that are talked about in this process of awakening and in these emergent phenomena, which is just another way to say these spiritual experiences. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of crossover between psychedelics, spiritual experiences, and some things that present themselves like schizophrenia or psychosis. And so, you know, it kind of goes back to your question. How do you know that you're not going insane? Well, they're trying to figure that out.
How do you know the insane aren't more enlightened
than the average person, I can't remember.
Right? Because you probably are.
I can't remember who said it, but I can't remember who said the quote. But the quote is, normal is the sociopathology or the how did it go? Normal is the psychopathology of the average that is so widespread that it goes unnoticed, which I thought was a great quote. I can't remember who said it, but somebody looked that up. Jamie, pull that up. Yeah. So, yeah, man. But they're doing a lot of work with that in particular, is like trying to really get to the root of that. Like, you know, maybe these people who are quote unquote schizophrenic are really just having some sort of spiritual experience, or as they would put it, emergent phenomenological experience.
I've always kind of felt that way, that, you know, what we perceive, that the people that we perceive as insane are just people that are lacking certain filters. So they're perceiving bits and pieces of reality that you and I are not, because we have those filters up.
Right. And see, then that's the funny thing about that is, and I'm glad you used that particular term, filter, because that's what it is, right? We have these perceptual filters, and this whole awakening process is really just at its core what it is. It's getting underneath those filters. That's what we're really doing, is we're moving underneath the filters back towards the unconditioned mind before these perceptual filters were installed.
Do you think there's other levels of awakening for you to experience yet?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I'm sure that this is, and I've had deeper insights since the initial shift, which was, like I said, just the default mode network shutting off, and kind of losing that sense of a fixed, permanent, abiding self. But yeah, I've had some like deeper insights since then, which, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about at some point. But
so when it turned off for you, mm-hmm. did you just wake up one morning and the chatter was gone?
Yeah, basically. So I was just sitting doing normal, like I kind of had a rhythm to the way that I was doing things. I would start with just a basic mindfulness of breathing, just to kind of get my concentration on point and kind of start entering into the jhana phases, you know, the like first states of meditative absorption. And from there, I would do a little bit of body scanning, like Goenka, Vipassana style body scanning. And then a lot of it after that, I would just do nothing. I would just do nothing. And sometimes I would do self-inquiry practice, you know, like again, like looking for the self kind of a thing. But you can only take that so far until you come to the nothing. But a lot of it was just this process of contraction and expansion. So again, contracting the mind with just concentration practice, general samadhi practice, focusing on the breath, doing body scanning, and then opening it up. And mm-hmm. So there's this contraction and then an expansion. And just that was my practice, was contraction, expansion, contraction, expansion. And I did that for, you know, a while. Again, I did take a break for a hot minute, you know, like I said, about 2.5-3 months or so, where I was just being mindful, doing everything else, and just stopped sitting. But, you know, I was still obviously practicing, you know. And so, you know, like, I mean, in most of my life, honestly, even so, I'm kind of an odd bird in that, you know, I do construction for a living. That's the way I'm still making my money at this point. But even at work, so like I would just put an earbud in, and like all day at work, I would like listen to Dharma talks. You know, rather than music, I would listen to Dharma talks. In the gym, I would listen to Dharma talks. Like if I wasn't writing a Dharma talk or listening to a Dharma talk or sitting, like, I mean, the practice was my life. It is my life. It has been my life. for years now. And so I think that that may have a lot to do with it, you know, because I am so deeply immersed in it.
I totally identify with that. You know? Yeah. That's interesting. So what benefit do you think this will bring to humanity? Do you think that this, actually, no, scratch everything I just said, that didn't make any sense anyway. Although it probably did in some particular realm of existence.
I'm sure we could have made something out of it.
Do you think that there's an awakening going on, just in general, societal awakening?
I mean, in what sense? Like a spiritual awakening?
A spiritual awakening, paradigm shift, whatever you want to call it.
I would like for there to be. And I'm going to give you a very honest answer that may be a little controversial. I think that there is a large draw towards spiritual practice. I don't know that there's a lot of awakening happening. I think a lot of people really lean into it and just make it another identity, which I think ultimately prevents them from actually waking up. Because anything we cling to is going to prevent us from awakening. So when we get into the spiritual, and I know plenty of people that do this, and you know, they are where they are. And this is not a judgment call by any means. Like, I've been there, you know, I've got the tattoos to show it. But at some point we have to realize that all the paths are also a trap. Mm-hmm. Right? And we have to let go of that too. And so, you know, there's a lot of this, what Chogyam Trungpa called spiritual materialism going on right now, where, you know, people lean into these practices and it's a cool thing to do. And they like to talk about how spiritual they are and, you know, how they're light workers or some such ilk. And they, you know, they dress like they're hippies in the 60s and they make an identity out of it. They make it their personality. But again, by making that your personality, you're just making more solidity. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to let go of that too. You have to let go of the path. You have to let go of sitting meditation. You have to, you know what I'm saying? At the end of the day, it's not very Buddhist to be a Buddhist.
What's that saying? If you see the Buddha walking down the street, kill him.
Right. Yeah, it's you have to let go of all of that. Like, you know, you have to let go of any preconceived notions about what you are or what you think you are.
Yeah. But this spiritual materialism, it has to be part of the path, otherwise it wouldn't exist.
I mean, it's all part of the path.
Right? So we all had to go through the spiritual materialism.
That's why I said I said it's not a judgment call. And I've done it. I mean, I got the tattoos to prove it. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, so it's like part of the path.
You don't get a bunch of like really Buddhist tattoos unless you're a little spiritual materialist, right? But that's just something else I had to, that's part of my path, man. You know, it's just, here we are. Eventually you got to let go of that shit too. And yeah, it's a thing I do, but it's not who I am. And so, yeah, there's that, you know, like I haven't called myself a Buddhist for a long time. I if anything, I say I'm a Dharma practitioner. Because that's what it is, right? I practice the Dharma. I'm not me. I'm not anything.
Yeah, I dropped using the term Buddhist a while ago, I guess.
Yeah.
Spiritualist or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, not even that. Like, again, label, thought, mm-hmm. thought. So, like, we have to do away with all that. Anything we can use to define ourselves, thought. It's a thought. It's all just thought. We live in this world of thought and concepts. And it's, again, by conceptualizing and labeling things that we create this division, this illusion of a division. At least we created in our perception.
So do you believe that Buddhism is the only path to enlightenment, or do you believe that there are other paths that will also?
Yeah.
Or a person doesn't need a path because the path is the pathless path, right?
I mean, pretty much. I don't feel like Buddhism is the only path. I feel like all paths lead to the same end, but I don't feel like it's the only path by any means. It's a path, and it's a path that works, and I can say that from my own experience. I can verify that through my own experience, but you know, lots of paths out there. Pick one and stick with it.
All right. Do you think using shortcuts? Oh, not shortcuts. I don't like that term, actually. Do you think using things like psychedelics or cannabis and ayahuasca, things like that, some people will say that they're a shortcut. What do you think?
I mean, maybe. I suppose if they were used in a manner where they were being used as a tool, like a tool for insight, perhaps, they could expedite the process a little bit. You know, there is a bit of neuroplasticity involved with psychedelics that I feel like, you know, with the right teachings and the right pointing could probably facilitate some sort of a shift. Like how long that stays for, that's the question, right? So, because we have most people who have had like high dose psychedelic experiences have had these mystical experiences, these emergent phenomena happen. They've had these, you know, peak mystical experiences. Like I'm sure you have, right? Mm-hmm. You've experienced a mystical experience on psychedelics. It's like, yeah. And again, this is where we can kind of come back to the knowing versus the experiential versus the realized. So psychedelics would fall into that second category of experiential. Like we can experience this oneness. We can experience this non-dual state. But it's kind of like Ram Dass said. He's like, you know, psychedelics are great. They let you walk in the garden for a couple hours, but then you always got to get kicked out, right? So with the realization, you're just kind of there. And, you know, that's not to say that, like, I mean, this is, again, the no self thing is just this first shift in this whole process. There's who knows where it ends. I can't say. I have no idea. I know where it begins, and it begins with that. But what were we talking about? I completely spaced.
Yeah.
Oh, psychedelics. We were talking about psychedelics. So, you know, we can experience these peak experiences and these shifts on there, and perhaps it could be tools, like you know, it goes back to that old story about the monk who meditated for 25 years so he could levitate across the river, and his teacher's like, man, there's a ferry's only a nickel, you know, like, you spent 25 years of your life, you know. People get locked into this identity of the meditator, you know, of the person on the path, of the spiritual seeker, and all that does is just keep us from the thing.
But as long as it's fun.
Yeah, just have fun. That's it. That's the karma. Have fun.
Make it enjoyable.
Yeah. We could sum up the Dharma like that. Like, hey, have you noticed that life is going to have these experiences in it that are a little difficult? Why not have some fun? People take spirituality too fucking seriously. Quite honestly.
Yeah. No, I don't know if there's anything more healing in the world than joy.
That's the most healing thing. That's all there is. If it wasn't all bliss, it wouldn't exist.
I never heard that one.
I don't know. That was a thing that came to me while I was sitting one day.
You should title your book that.
Nah, maybe. That'll be the second one. That'll be the follow-up to Dharma Junkie.
So what else is new?
Not much, man. Same old stuff. Life on the coast. Yeah. It's hot, it's cold. No, I'm in school, just trying to do that whole thing, man. Just going to school and working and living life. Just enjoying it, man.
Cool. Well, they definitely need a guy like you down there in the Gulf Coast.
I feel like you're probably right.
So, before we wrap it up, man, it's been great fucking chatting with you. Good seeing you again.
Yeah, man.
And where can people find you?
Oh, so people can find me on all the socials. You can find me on Instagram, Gulf Coast Dharma. You can check out the website, gulfcoastdharma.org. And you can also check out the podcast. It's Dharma Junkie, and it's everywhere podcasts are found. And yeah, shoot me a message. And I'm starting to work with people like one-on-one, doing some like kind of meditation, coaching, teaching, whatever you want to call it. I don't know what to call it. Spiritual guidance, help up along this path and this process of awakening and stuff. So if people want to do that, they can shoot me an email, justin@gulfcoastdharma.org.
Awesome. I'll put those links in the notes of this episode so my listeners can find you. I still do not have a website or an outro to play. So if people want to contact me, you can reach me at everythingimaginable2020.com and everythingimaginable2020@gmail.com. And, you know, maybe one day I'll put up another website. We'll see. And that is it. Let's see.
Recording stopped.